Hello and welcome to Tech Tent, your weekly status update on the technology business. I'm Rory Catlin-Jones, and this week we're in London's Science Museum. With me are Carolyn Rice from our online technology desk.
Hello, Rory.
And LJ Rich from BBC TV's tech show Click.
Hello.
And also, we've got a very special guest, Charlotte Connolly, curator at the museum working on the information age. And in fact, we're standing right next to what's going to be a hugely important artefact in the biggest exhibition this museum has ever staged. It's part of the history of computing, part of life as we know it, really. Charlotte, what are we looking at?
Well, we're looking at a black box that doesn't really tell you much, but there's a very important sticker on it that says, "This machine is a server. Do not power down." And the reason that's important is because this is what the very first website was hosted on. This is the computer that Tim Berners-Lee used to develop the World Wide Web, and it's called the Next Cube.
We're looking at the dawn of the information age.
Absolutely. You can trace all of our internet activity today back to this black box.
Well, for the rest of the programme, we've relocated ourselves above the museum's antenna gallery. Appropriate, really, because many of our stories this week are about communications technology. For a start, Weibo. Now, that's China's version of Twitter, and some say a much more innovative service than the American one. This week, its shares have arrived on New York's NASDAQ, but like its American counterpart, Weibo is still losing money, and the reception for its shares in New York, I think it's fair to say, was somewhat underwhelming. Perhaps that's because the social media scene in China changes so rapidly that investors are asking whether it's wise to bet on any one company. I spoke to Chang Zhang, a Chinese media analyst at BBC Monitoring.
Weibo only rose in the last 4 years, and no one predicted its rise. It's very, very rapid rise. And now we have WeChat, which is the Chinese internet user's new darling. And WeChat's rise was also not predicted, really. And part of the question is the domestic environment, both commercial, technological, and also political, are changing very fast. WeChat's rise owe a large part to China's political environment, in which social media comments are being more strictly controlled.
Now, we've got this interesting situation where Weibo is trying to internationalize itself. Can you see it being attractive outside China?
It has already attracted quite a lot of users from outside of China. There are obviously a very large diaspora, Chinese diaspora, in the West. And also foreign celebrities such as actors like Brad Pitt, among others, and British Prime Minister David Cameron. They have all got accounts on Sino Weibo. But as I said, it's quite heavily censored in China. It's got into a bit of a trouble in China, so I'm not sure how well its international campaign will go.
Now, how are people using it? Are they using it differently from, say, how many of us use Twitter?
I think it does differ quite a lot, because like on Twitter, on Weibo you can write 140 characters, but 140 Chinese characters can say a lot more than 140 characters in Latin letters. On Weibo, you can voice, you can write statements, I mean, longer statements, more established views on Weibo. And in the Chinese society, I think social media networks such as Weibo play a much more important role than their counterparts in the West, because in China, traditional media are very heavily controlled by the state. And people are always looking for alternative sources of information. And that's why people attach much more importance to what they read on social media.
Chang Zhang there. Now, Charlotte Connolly from London's Science Museum. You're the information age curator here. Social media is an extraordinary phenomenon. It must be quite difficult working in a museum which is trying to look at the big picture. It keeps changing, doesn't it? I mean, we've seen from what's happened in China just in a few years. How do you see social media in this context?
Within the museum, it's a huge challenge. So supposing we want to tell a story from 50 years ago, we might put a letter on display. And it's a really important thing that someone's kept and preserved. I don't know that anyone's going to keep and preserve their favourite tweet or Facebook post in the same way. So it's definitely going to be a challenge for the curators of the future.
You need us to start archiving. You can archive your tweets and so on. And it is a global phenomenon. That's important. And it's different in different parts of the world. That's what we heard from China there.
Absolutely. And it's the same across all kinds of software, actually. It's not just communication software. But yeah, it's going to be a huge challenge. It is a huge challenge. But we're swimming in this stuff all the time, so it's really important that we do find a way of preserving it because it's such a key part of our culture.
Caroline Rice, you and I went to China not that long ago, a year or so back, and we looked at a social media giant, another one called Tencent. Remind us what really struck you about that.
Well, I was really surprised at just their scope and ambition. I mean, I remember going to their headquarters. We were talking, I think, 6 or 7-story building. They had TV studios. They were producing shows that just were linked to Tencent. I mean, when we're used to Twitter, which I still just associate mainly with writing tweets, the ambition of this company really amazed me, and I think they're setting the agenda for future social media.
LJ Rich, you've tweeted from China, I believe. It's actually quite difficult to do social media when you travel there.
Well, I went there back in 2008, and I actually was able to tweet using SMS text messaging. And at the time, Twitter wasn't, I don't think it was on the radar in China. So I actually ended up in an internet cafe surrounded by actually Shaolin monks playing World of Warcraft type games. I couldn't get on WordPress, but I could get on Twitter at the time. But it was definitely an interesting experience.
Right, well, we've got to move on. Let's have a look at some of the other big stories of the week. The Heartbleed bug, which threatened the security of hundreds of thousands of websites, that occupied us on last week's programme. And there's been more fallout in recent days. LJ, take us through that.
Yes, I mean, the latest development is the Royal Canadian Mounted Police have arrested somebody under suspicion of stealing 900 social insurance numbers. And he's exploited the Heartbleed vulnerability, which is, of course, sending the web into a bit of a spin. Mumsnet was also hacked using the
That's
same
a UK thing. Parenting site.
Yes, yes. That was hacked using the same vulnerability. Passwords were being released online. I mean, the whole thing is, it just shows fresh passwords are the best passwords, and you can use things like password managers to help you navigate the mayhem that is trying to sign into many websites. And of course, the advice that I'm just going to repeat here is use different passwords for your banking, your personal email with all of your stuff, and of course all these other social media sites.
And Caroline Rice, a bunch of big company results this week. Google not doing so well. People are asking a few questions about whether flashy projects like Google Glass are kind of diverting them from the core business.
Well, is your Google Glass diverting you, Rory? You're wearing it right
is.
Now.
Yes,
I mean, profits up at Google, but lower than expectations. But interestingly, their shares were down. Investors are still worried about this problem with advertising. You pay per click for an advert on Google, and the average cost in this first quarter set of results was down 9%. They're struggling with this move to mobile. Advertisers are still reluctant to pay as much for a mobile ad as they are for a traditional ad on a desktop site. And analysts are sort of saying maybe it's time for Google to focus on the less crazy ideas and concentrate on trying to be a more profitable company.
It's funny that, isn't it, though? Because Google's share price rose so high they had to split the shares. So I suppose any tiny disappointment in these slightly fragile times in the stock market causes people to go, oh dear, is something going badly wrong?
Yeah, definitely. And the NASDAQ, the stock exchange that has very, very tech-heavy companies on it, you know, is down 6% at the moment since the start of the year. So tech companies causing a bit of an issue. And both IBM and Intel reported their first quarter results. IBM, the lowest quarterly revenues in 5 years. Is the lower hardware sales, they're struggling a bit, and Intel beat expectations, but because there's now slower demand for PCs, they're looking for new markets. They kind of missed the boat a bit with tablets, but are hoping to focus on smartwatches and things like that.
Yeah, they're desperately trying to say we are going to be big in mobile, but they're struggling to keep up with Arm, the British based company, which is the main designer of chips there. Well, let's move on with a little musical interlude. Our colleagues on BBC TV's Click are going to be taking a look at the technology of music this weekend, including something that can turn this... into this. Uh, LJ Rich, you know what that's about. You've put together a report on this, and you were one of the singers, I believe, we just heard. What
yes.
was that all about?
I was doing the high notes in that case, and it's basically lowering the barriers to creativity. You don't need to learn the violin for many years to play one. Instead, you can just sing a note into a computer, and using this program called Imitone, the computer can recognize the note you're singing fast enough to play an instrument in the same note as well. Thus, hilarity ensues in this weekend's show, which is all about music technology, my favourite subject.
Really fascinating area. Musicians and the computer world really have been a very good marriage over the years. You're listening to Tech Tent on the BBC World Service. I'm Rory Catlin-Jones. Now, by 2014, Wi-Fi was supposed to be everywhere. Wherever you went, there would be a good internet connection, probably made available for free in cities by municipal authorities or generous companies, or places like the Science Museum where we are now. But it hasn't quite worked out like that. Wi-Fi is still quite fragmented, sometimes good, sometimes poor, often expensive. In a moment, we'll hear from the man behind the world's biggest social Wi-Fi network. But first, someone who set out to map Wi-Fi and encourage providers to up their game. Lithuania-based Artūras Jonkus has launched a smartphone app called Rotten Wi-Fi. He explained.
We really want to help people to choose Wi-Fi while they're traveling. Also, with sarcastic pictures, we want to force businesses and public authorities to improve quality of Wi-Fi in their countries.
So we'll all be able to get online a bit easier, that's the hope, because we've all sat at conferences where the Wi-Fi just didn't work.
Yep, that's true.
What you don't put on here is anything about security. I've done some work on the security of public Wi-Fi. Mostly, it's very insecure and quite dangerous, actually.
Yes, that's why we are partnering and talking with one of the VPN providers, private Wi-Fi, because they're really concerned about this issue. Our users, they are used to using internet on public Wi-Fi. At the same time, it's not really safe. So we will have some actions together, not only to promote where people could get free Wi-Fi, but also that they should care about their data, and especially not to go on public Wi-Fi to their bank accounts, to other sensitive information, because otherwise they could really suffer from that.
Artūras Jonkus. Now, 9 years ago, Martin Varshavsky launched what sounded like a crazy idea, a social Wi-Fi network where you plugged a piece of kit into your home router and then shared your Wi-Fi with anyone passing by. But FON, as he called it, has grown into a global network in 13 million homes. This week, he launched a new product called Gramophone, which is designed to turn FON into a social music network. But when he joined me for a coffee, I asked him whether public Wi-Fi was, in fact, an idea that had failed.
Well, Wi-Fi has been called dead many times, and it has survived a lot of different attempts, not all of them successful, I agree with you, especially the attempts of turning cities into telecom companies and offering Wi-Fi. I personally am not a fan of that attempt because I think governments used to own telcos. They privatized them, and I don't see why they should own them again to privatize them again later on. I think the phone model is interesting because there's already so much Wi-Fi. Go to Paris, go to Tokyo, go to New York, go to any city. You'll find Wi-Fi everywhere. What we deal with is the fact that a lot of that Wi-Fi is locked, and we come up with intelligent ways, quid pro quo. Like if you open your Wi-Fi, I open mine. It's a global federation of open Wi-Fi that's built upon existing Wi-Fi, not municipal Wi-Fi efforts of the kind that you mentioned.
Now, you've got this new product coming out called Gramophone. Tell us about that.
So we made Wi-Fi social. But on top of that, the Gramophone gives you social music. At the present, it works with Spotify, but later on it will work with other services. So your friends can play music at your home. because we check if your guest is a friend of Facebook. And we assume that if somebody's your friend on Facebook and it's inside, this person is inside your home, they should be able both to use your Wi-Fi and to select the music that's playing at home.
Martin Warszawski there. Now, Charlotte Connolly, curator at the Science Museum, we're always being told about how we're in the middle of this extraordinary information age. Actually, the networks are not really there, are they yet? That's the dream that's still failed to materialise.
It is, and certainly in urban places like London, we're very lucky and we're pretty well connected, but the rural areas have got a long way to come. So 4G has just launched on the mobile networks, and 5G is just around the corner. And I think for a lot of the mobile phone industry, they've stopped thinking that there's a lot of growth in personal communications. So how many more mobile phones are they realistically going to sell? Probably not many. So instead, they're starting to look towards something called machine-to-machine communication or the Internet of Things. So that might be that you have some sort of smart device in your car that talks maybe to the manufacturer, perhaps to your direction-finding system. So it's talking from your car, a machine, to another machine.
And that's going to need good networks. I mean, is it going to be Wi-Fi? Is it going to be 4G, 5G? I mean, the advantage of Wi-Fi is it's been cheap for people to use. The advantage of mobile phone networks is that they're seamless.
Absolutely. And I think we don't quite know yet. There are a lot of people thinking very carefully about it. But certainly the way the planning is looking is perhaps thinking about how we use the spectrum, which is this resource. So at the minute, broadcasting networks, the television, the radio, use a huge chunk of spectrum. And as we digitize them, we can make it use a little bit less spectrum and perhaps free that up for mobile internet systems. Let's
bring in Carolyn Rice and LJ Rich on the frustrations of being connected. Carolyn, does it drive you mad when you go from place to place and you can't get online? Wi-Fi's not really there?
Definitely. I think we've become so used to just having internet access now, particularly when we work in the sort of industry where we do, where you're quite often out covering something and it's very easy just to expect it there. But I found I tend to buy a little device with a SIM card in that guarantees me I'll have Wi-Fi pretty much wherever I go, and that's how I've sort of got round it.
LJ, what's your take on this?
I'm pretty much the same. I actually brought a separate mobile phone out with me in America so that I could have my own personal hotspot and make calls at the same time. I tend to get quite upset if I'm not fed or connected.
Fine. Well, let's move on and try a bit of word association. If I said BitTorrent, what would you say? I bet that many would say piracy or file sharing. But the organisation behind the software which millions do use to share music and movies they may not have got hold of legally wants the world to know it's a perfectly legitimate business. They've been joining up with the owners of digital content to create BitTorrent bundles, a lawful way of obtaining copyright material. Matt Mason, newly appointed marketing director for BitTorrent, popped in the other day to explain.
People are starting to understand that BitTorrent isn't an illegal downloading thing that people kind of think it's this amorphous piracy tool, when what it actually is a protocol. It's a way of moving data and information across the internet, the same way as HTTP is the protocol we use to move web traffic. BitTorrent is for moving larger files, larger data sets across the internet, and it moves more traffic every day than HTTP.
Isn't it still true that the majority of its use is for downloading copyrighted material?
No, so there's a lot of studies that say 99% of BitTorrent traffic is piracy. If you look at those studies are looking at open trackers on piracy sites and making the assumption that that's all BitTorrent traffic, when in fact every time Facebook updates Facebook, they use BitTorrent to do that. Same thing with Twitter, Wikipedia, Etsy, World of Warcraft. Anybody who's using a large server array to update a large set of servers and send lots of information to lots of places at once is probably using BitTorrent to do so. It's used by experiments like the Large Hadron Collider to do data crunching and moving large data sets around. It's used on Wall Street to move around algorithms for high-frequency trading. It's used for a ton of stuff, but if you're a research firm commissioned by Hollywood to go and look at piracy, you're not going to be finding that stuff.
So you would say you're an essential tool for people managing traffic on the internet?
Absolutely. BitTorrent is one of the backbones of the internet.
But you do have this branding problem. Is that something that occupies you? Do you sit around saying, how could we not be labelled the pirate facility?
Oh, it's definitely a problem. It's definitely something we think about. We're a technology company. We make a number of different technologies that serve the internet and serve society in a number of different ways. And we're passionate about the idea of doing things without servers, which is the sort of big idea of BitTorrent, like using the endpoints, people and their devices, as the power to power something. So we have products like BitTorrent Sync, which is essentially like Dropbox, but with no cloud. That's a really good idea because it means that you don't have to pay loads of money to set up and maintain a cloud. It's also a good idea because it means the NSA can't look at that cloud and see what you're doing.
It's the ultimate in crowdsourcing technology, really.
Absolutely. It's designed to work the way the internet works, which is putting intelligence at the edge. And we're really, I think of us as a sustainable technology company. We think about how do we do things that can really scale. Having to build giant server farms and air condition them to cool them down, it's not really sustainable, even if you've got billions of dollars the way somebody like Google has. We think there's better ways that we can do certain things on the internet.
Matt Mason there. LJ Rich, I interrupted you when you were about to tell us something rather interesting about the way people name their Wi-Fi networks, perhaps to discourage sharing.
I think there's definitely something in this is your chance to express yourself to the wider world, and they range from witty commentary on modern society, like your Wi-Fi is called NSA Surveillance Station 3 or FBI Surveillance Van 56. You've also got the passive-aggressive ones, like stop moving furniture at night. You've got cultural references like Silence of the Lambs and Drop It Like It's Hotspot. You've got historical puns like Alexander Graham Belkin, Abraham Lynxis, and geek gags, c:/virus.exe, who would like to connect to that, and finally my personal favourite, Lord of the Pings.
I think I might have to rechristen my Wi-Fi Heartbleed, and that really will put somebody off from trying to share it. Finally, as some of you listening will be marking Easter this weekend, our minds turned to the software form of the Easter egg, those hidden treasures in software or websites that appear if you press certain little known sequences of keys and so on. Carolyn Rice, what's this about?
Yes, well, this is sort of software coders tend to put some little tricks into pages when they're developing them. Just fun, basically. It doesn't happen very often in life, but these are just for fun. And a couple of my favourite are, if you go to Vogue's website or GQ, the men's fashion magazine, and type in that classic sequence of up, up, down, down, left, right, BA, known to any gamer, you'll see some very fashionable dinosaurs. Or my other favourite one is, if you go to Google search engine and type in do a barrel roll. I'm not going to tell you what happens. Try it and see.
Try it. Charlotte Connolly, a bit of fun. Is that something that you've tried?
Not me personally, that one. The up, up, down, down is a little bit tricky. But my favourite one at the minute, if you go to the British Museum's website and put in Go Berserk, you get a nice Viking surprise.
Ooh. Well, that's a great tip for us and a good note on which to draw to a close, because that's all we've got time for this week. Thanks to my special guest, Charlotte Connolly, curator here at the Science Museum in London, where she's working on a huge Information Age exhibition opening later this year. Thanks to our own Carolyn Rice from the BBC Tech Desk and LJ Rich from BBC TV Click. Don't forget our podcast and join us again next time.